Welcome back to Coast to Coast. There's nothing more credible than a police officer and a UFO report. I keep thinking about the late Lonnie Zamora, the police officer from Socorro, New Mexico, who witnessed one incredible UFO case. In a moment, Linda talks more about police and UFOs on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, back with Linda Moulton Howe with a case of UFOs. What do you have for us, Linda?
Well, 25 years ago, north of Jacksonville, near the Florida and Georgia border, 34-year-old Nassau County patrol officer and helicopter pilot John Lowe was driving his patrol car in a very rural area known as King's Ferry on the St. Mary's River. That's near Hilliard. Hilliard is 32 miles northwest of Jacksonville and a few miles east of that Okefenokee National Wildlife Refuge that is so wild. And he ended up on a dirt road. He was driving slowly about a half hour before midnight. And the sky was dark and clear, and he decided to stop and stretch his legs. He parked near a clear-cut area where the trees had been taken out and gave a really clear view of the ground and the sky. And as he looked off in the distance where the clear-cut was, a light in the sky caught his eye. Here now from Nassau County, Florida, is retired patrol officer and helicopter pilot Eric Lowe.
I looked up in the sky, and I caught movement in the air up there. I was thinking that it was probably a jet, but I didn't see the strobes on this object, almost like an LED light, a bright white light. And this was at some distance. It was miles from where I was at in the sky. But it was still a prominent object that I could see. I'm a helicopter pilot, and I'm familiar with aircraft. I didn't hear an airplane engine droning. I didn't hear rotors. It was quiet. And I watched this object for a little while, and then it moved slowly across my area of vision, which was horizontally. And I noticed that it stopped. When it stopped, I was thinking, well, maybe it's a jet, and it made a turn and was going away from me, but the light didn't get any smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I got my binoculars out of my console in my car, and I looked at this object. It was a bright white light, like an LED. And while I was watching it, it began to move again.
So now you're watching through your binoculars?
Yes, ma'am.
In the binoculars, what are you seeing in terms of shading of any color or anything?
No color, just a plain white orb. And through my binoculars, it was magnified to about the size of a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't hold the binoculars very steady, even though I was bracing myself on the roof of my patrol car. The object moved slowly, and when it moved out of my field of vision, I refocused without the binoculars looking at it again. And this object stopped again. And when it stopped this time, it went in reverse. I was amazed at what I was seeing. I reached into my console then, and I got an instrument that I use whenever I did traffic crash diagrams, which was a straight edge. And I held it up, and I watched this object horizontally go across the top of my straight edge, and it went up off of the straight edge. When it went off of the straight edge, it zigzagged.
Hmm.
It was a subtle movement. None of this was very fast. When I finally lost sight of it, it just faded out.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't see it anymore. And at night, I learned that when you're focusing on something, you can lose vision of an object. But if you look away from an object, you can catch the movement again out of your peripheral vision. And I tried to do that, and it just wasn't there anymore.
Well, that is a classic description of the UFO phenomena for centuries, really.
Yes, ma'am.
And it is as if the phenomena flaunts itself, taunts humans that watch it, appears to be aware of human consciousness on it, and that these forward, backward, zigzag motions are what have separated the UFO phenomena from normal aviation now for a century.
Yes, ma'am.
Did anything else happen after that? Did you receive any telepathic images thoughts? Did you have any vivid dreams after that night?
No, ma'am. It was humorous that I'd actually seen this, because I read a lot about the subject, the phenomena, when I was younger, and always found it fascinating. Even if I watched, like, your program, for instance, I've learned a lot by watching what comes on the History Channel.
Yeah, the Ancient Aliens series.
Yes, ma'am. Recently, what prompted me to do this is I read the article about Commander David Fravor.
Yes.
Retired Navy commander.
You are referring to the December 16th, 2017 headline in the New York Times on the front page about infrared FLIR video taken by jet fighter gun. What was your reaction to reading that headline?
Well, like, when I read it, I was immediately drawn to it. I wanted to know more about what the facts were. For the very first time, I saw the video on the History Channel, the Ancient Aliens episode, and I stood there with my jaw open watching what this man had been looking through his FLIR, and I would have been amazed and terrified if I was that man. It was fascinating.
Mr. Lowe, you're speaking not only as a longtime correctional officer and a road patrolman, but you're speaking as a helicopter pilot.
Yes, ma'am.
And so your perspective on what you saw in the infrared video that was provided by the New York Times through the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program that was in the Pentagon.
Yes, ma'am.
From your perspective as a helicopter pilot, you are looking at this infrared, and what is your bottom line?
The infrared is picking up a heat signature, and it's reflected back into that camera, and that camera doesn't lie. If there is something out there to be captured that is hot, it's going to pick it up. I've operated a FLIR unit before, and I'm familiar with its operation. You can make that device as intrusive as you need to make it for it to work, which means the intensity of this thing is variable. So if you're looking through clouds, for instance, and one of those things are there, if it's giving off any kind of a heat signature, you're going to see it. So these pilots that are looking at these things, they know exactly what they're looking at. And their machinery, their aircraft, is measuring distance and speed, and the maneuverability is kind of speaking for itself in the video. If you can see this object like the commander did and see that it's rotating while it's moving, that device is pretty accurate.
Right. What did you perceive when the object, the UFO, moved? And some estimates have been that it was moving so fast.
Right. Moving across the horizon.
But on the FLIR infrared video that was featured in the New York Times in December of 2017, there was one of the videos, the object moved so fast off to the lower left that some people estimated that it might have been moving like almost 100,000 miles an hour.
Yes, ma'am. I would not doubt that. For an aircraft to move that fast, a conventional aircraft at that speed inside our atmosphere would burn up. The wings would be burned off of that aircraft. Sheer wind friction would just burn that aircraft up if it was moving that fast. The fastest jet known to man, the Blackbird, the SR-17 or 71, that thing flew at Mach 3. And when the pilot got out of that, the skin on that aircraft remained white hot for an hour. So anything that flies that fast is going to have, it's almost like the shuttle is a good example. When that thing landed, they couldn't just open the door and let those people out. They had to wait for that pile to cool. And that's just simply from air making it so hot.
Right.
Being superheated like an oven because it just came from outer space into our atmosphere.
Right.
Which is something that should impede the speed of an aircraft like that. But these things, those rules just don't apply. The idea of something moving across the spectrum at such a speed in those videos that I've seen, the most recent ones that they released, there's one in particular where you are seeing this object moving across from right to left in the screen. This thing is moving so fast, that there is no possible way that that jet could have caught up to it or even closed on it or maintained a certain distance from it to observe it. It just left this F-17 or F-18 in the dust. Amazing. We were lucky to catch it on the FLIR. It was moving so fast.
Right.
Boggles the mind. And kind of reassured my feeling that we are being visited. And it's more often than people realize, I think. Everyone that says we're alone, I believe that these entities travel in a method that we just are not familiar with whatsoever. And they travel interdimensionally, and they can bend space to get here. And the reason I say that is because in my reading and what I've learned and what I've seen, the only thing that makes any sense to me is that these things just appear out of nowhere because that is the point in which they materialize. So if you understand what I'm saying,
yep.
The object, wherever it comes from, it doesn't choose the exact spot, but when it comes through that portal, we'll call it, and people are present, they're going to see it. And it looks like it just materialized, like in so many other cases that I've read about. If we could get our hands on that kind of technology, this world would be a much, much different place.
And it also brings into focus that when you and so many others see a bright light that reverses, that goes up, that does zigzags, and then it doesn't move off in Euclidean geometry. It simply fades out or pops out.
That is it. Exactly. Yes, ma'am.
That is the interdimensional aspect of the UFO phenomena, popping in and popping out.
Right. And I believe that. They probably laugh at our geometry. You know, honestly, we're so antiquated, I'm sure, to that entity. I'm pretty sure that we're laughable. I know we are. We would have to be. If I were them looking back at us, they probably, if they have a sense of humor, I'm pretty sure they probably laughed at us quite a bit.
And it is why they seem to flaunt their ability in front of humans as if you can't figure this out.
I think they're toying with us to a degree. Until they're ready, the ball is in their field. Until they're ready to let us that we know that they're here, then we're going to keep playing games with these entities until we get absolute, honest-to-God, hard evidence that they exist. I think that we already have that, and I think that everything that I just said about their ability scares the living bejesus out of our government and other governments, and they don't want to admit that.
I like that story.
Yeah, he is one of the most down-to-earth persons who has had a position of authority having to do with law enforcement his entire life and had this experience where he had presence of mind to get out that straight edge using his left brain, analytical, and then going into his perspective as a helicopter pilot who has used FLIR and looking at what was released a year ago in the New York Times. I just thought that this was the classic UFO, and then it goes on into his other thoughts about infrared, and that it shows that we are in a world now where everyone, including police, they are much, much more educated and aware than we think. And when I got through with that interview, I also thought of Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. And the police officer is implying the question about us being sort of toyed with, teased and taunted by this technology that is so superior. Well, in Colonel Corso's The Day After Roswell, he has a section where he says, it was the UFOs, the alien spacecraft, thinking themselves invulnerable and invisible as they soared around the edges of our atmosphere, swooping down at will to destroy our communications with EMP bursts. And he says that because he says that did occur, that the alien presence has more than once done an electromagnetic pulse that has destroyed or brought down our communications. have buzzed our spacecraft, have colonized our lunar surface. That means that we have direct knowledge that there is an alien presence also on the moon, that they mutilate cattle in their own biological experiments, and even abduct human beings for their medical tests and hybridization of the species. And what was worse, we had to let them do it because we had no weapon to defend ourselves. These creatures were not benevolent. They did not come here to enlighten human beings. They were genetically altered humanoid automatons, cloned biological entities who were harvesting biological specimens on Earth for their own experimentation. As long as we were incapable of defending ourselves.
They had free will, didn't they?
That's right. They had to allow it. And that was part of what this working group that he was referring to, Majestic 12, had to deal with. We had negotiated a kind of surrender with them as long as we could not fight them. They dictated the terms because they knew what we most feared was disclosure. Now, here's the sentence. Hide the truth, and the truth becomes your enemy. Disclose the truth, and it becomes your weapon. We hid the truth, and the Evens used it against us until 1974, when we had our first real shootdown of an alien craft over Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany. When the truth of alien intervention in our planet's affairs and our own ongoing contact with an alien culture is finally revealed, it won't be frightening, even though it will be a shock, quote unquote, Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, the day after Roswell.
Does any of this, Linda, because you've studied this, you've investigated it for years, does any of it scare you as a person?
No, not really.
Why not?
I think it's because we are on a planet with 7.2 billion Homo sapien, and no matter how many alien species are here throughout the solar system, the Milky Way galaxy, and on, it's very clear that there's been no focus on, let's say, the elimination of humans as a species. In fact, I would say that the evidence suggests that we are extremely valuable to maybe one or more for harvesting genetic material. And that means if we could wake up and be conscious of everything that we are and the fact that Homo sapiens sapien, probably that abductions occur because we are alien genetics. It only makes sense. Even Genesis in the Bible talks about the Nephilim or angelic something coming and what? Finding the female humans fair. There's mating, and what do they have? They have a hybrid that turns out to be giants with six fingers and six toes. And that, so that's Genesis talking about exactly what we're talking about now. And it would seem to me that the only logic 2 + 2 = 4 is that Homo sapiens sapien is a hybrid species. We are part of whatever has made us, which means that we have a humanoid genetic connection to one or more humanoid species throughout the Milky Way galaxy and maybe beyond. That's why there is great interest in us on this planet. Therefore, it is perhaps mutually beneficial. And if you have a mutually beneficial situation, then for us to wake up, to understand what we are, what our relationship is with the alien presence, and why it needs all this genetic material from the Earth, then for the first time ever, Homo sapiens sapien might finally be able to stand on their own ground in their own minds and be able to stand strong in the face of something that once upon a time humans got down on their knees to and called them gods when they were not gods at all.
Next up, Linda looks at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. What are they doing with brain technology? And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We'll have conversations with Linda, your phone calls next hour. Questions, stories, and perhaps tips for her to follow up on. The next story has to do with the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, working on brain technology. What are they doing, Linda?
Well, believe it or not, it is like the telepathy that we've heard about by abductees in UFOs. It started for me on September 6th, and there was a news headline from DefenseOne.com technology reporter Patrick Tucker, and here's what it said, quote, a person with a brain chip can now pilot a swarm of drones or even advanced fighter jets thanks to research funded by the U.S. military's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. So we're talking about a brain chip that's put into a human brain that then allows the brain to interface and control drones or even advanced fighter jets.
Right, with the brain. Wow.
Yeah, this is telepathy. This is like the ET stuff, and I'll talk about that in after we hear from Patrick. Well, for the first time ever, DARPA has announced that it has demonstrated the use of telepathic thought. This is their word. Telepathic thought from a human brain embedded with a specific kind of computer chip that allows a person to command and control simultaneously three different types of drone aircraft by mental thoughts while watching the drones on a screen. And this was demonstrated in a DARPA simulator. DARPA's director of Biological Technology Office in National Harbor, Maryland, says, quote, the signals from those drone aircraft can be delivered directly back to the brain so that the human brain of that pilot can also perceive the environment around the aerial drones. It has taken a number of years to try and figure this out. We actually saw that the brain really cares about collective behaviors of swarms. And now we know where to record from and what to see from the brain signals in order to decode for collective behaviors so that the brain can interact with and control three or more aerial vehicles. Well, I called Defense One reporter Patrick Tucker for an update, and here he is now from his office in Washington, D.C., beginning with how he describes this new frontier.
New methods of mechanically and electrically connecting brains to computers to achieve new effects. In this particular case, the challenge of connecting a brain to the navigation and the steering system of a simulated aircraft. In 2015, they had a big accomplishment where they were able to demonstrate that it was possible by basically putting small electronic chips close to the motor cortex of a patient, someone actually who was paralyzed from the neck down, they could pick up the signals from the motor cortex, relay them through a computer, and show that that person was able to effectively steer a simulated F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft, a very sophisticated military aircraft, in a simulated environment. And that was something of a first.
People hooked up through these implants in the brain, were they watching a simulator the way a lot of people are interacting between what your eye and your brain are reacting to on a screen?
Right. And in this particular setting, it's entirely signals that are coming from the motor cortex. So it's sort of a conventional simulator with this very important distinction of the interface between the person and the simulated jet is entirely driven by signals from the motor cortex.
And that must seem shocking to the general public that we are now at a stage where telepathically connected between the brain and a machine that some pilot someplace could literally control one to three planes out in the sky.
Right, right, exactly. And that's sort of what brings us to the newest development that was announced last week. Building off of that previous research effort, DARPA just this year was able to increase the number of aircraft that a individual just with electronic signals emanating from the motor cortex carried over a brain chip interface was able to steer not one but actually three simulated aircraft. And this is an important detail as well, was able to actually get feedback from the simulated aircraft. So in many ways, it's closer to what we would call telepathic communication, relay of electronic signals between a computer interface and a human brain. A big part of the reason that the Defense Department and DARPA is undertaking this research, part of it has to deal with what's called optimizing soldier performance. They do imagine at some point it might be augmenting the abilities of people to steer a variety of aircraft, to walk farther, to jump higher, that sort of thing. But their more proximate objective is to actually help veterans that have returned from situations overseas engaged in combat where they perhaps are missing limbs. So a big part of this research has led to the development of what's called the Luke arm, and it is a prosthetic arm that connects to the motor cortex and functions really very much like an actual biological arm. So they've made some very important strides in bringing this technology to market. It's received FDA approval, and it's going to be available really for anyone that has suffered an amputation in the entire world. And part of that comes from this research into finding out exactly how the motor cortex functions, figuring out how to collect those electronic signals and relay them to a device that exists in the real world.
And Patrick, what you're describing is turning humans into cyborgs where there are disabilities or people need enhancement in, let's say, in a military environment. And to that end, it was Elon Musk just in the last few months who said, for humans to remain relevant in the coming world of artificial intelligence, they are going to be forced to become cyborgs.
Right. So this is a point that I hear from a lot of different people when you talk to the effects that artificial intelligence and increased mechanization that ever more sophisticated technology is going to have on human life. One note that continues to sound is this idea of the acceleration of activity, of life almost becoming too fast. There's electronic communication is much faster than biological communication. And so what Musk and many others have said, I think it's a fascinating point. It's this idea that in order to keep pace with information technology and mechanical intelligence, humans will have to develop a way to communicate with machines that are thinking, talking, and communicating with one another far faster than them. I do think that his research efforts in that area are fascinating and very worthy, because this is a wild and new and important frontier for human development, is understanding in much greater detail how the brain works and how it's going to interface with our mechanical, robotic, and artificial environment.
Well, I think it was just in the last year of 2016 to 2017 time period that Elon Musk has founded a new company in addition to Tesla and SpaceX. And this is a company that is producing what he calls Neuralace. The company is called Neuralink. And Neuralace, Musk has defined as, quote, brain-computer interface technology in an ultra-thin mesh that is implanted in the skull and forms a body of electrodes which are able to monitor brain function.
Mm-hmm.
Would this Neuralace now have grown from DARPA's research, or will DARPA reach out to get the Neuralace to interface between pilots and planes?
Well, much of the really great thing about all of this research right now that's taking place is that this is not classified research, right? This is stuff that has a variety of sources of funding in terms of the outputs of DARPA's efforts. None of that is classified. All of that is kind of available to researchers around the world and the general public. So you can imagine this research community between the National Science Foundation, the Department of Defense, which got some money for it, institutions of learning around the world, as well as now the private sector, all of them contributing to a much greater body of knowledge.
Have you been able to talk with any pilot who has been in any of the DARPA research to see if a fully functioning pilot has in some way, whether it's been on the outside of his head or an implant chip, been able to experience what it is like to telepathically control a drone.
Right. So far, all of the subjects for this research that DARPA has undertaken have actually been paraplegics, in part because they signed on to undertake this experimentation with DARPA. And through that experimentation, they realized some kind of extra motor function in the form of navigating a virtual environment. So it's not something that the Defense Department has done yet, where they've taken an actual operational pilot and conducted neuroscience or neurosurgery on that pilot to give them any of these devices and actually implant them, because that's where you start to get into a really tricky area. The science right now of neuroscience, it's revealed some wonderful things about how to replace capabilities people have lost either because of congenital effects or because of injury or something like that, bringing people back to a normal baseline. But if you are talking about moving people beyond that normal baseline and actually giving them something that you might call like super abilities, this is where there's really no scientific understanding of what that looks like. There's a lot of ethical concerns when you start to talk about how to embark on that experimentation. So you're not going to go down to an airbase or an aircraft carrier, and probably not in the near future anyway, and find fighter pilots that have cyborg chips that are implanted in them. But at the same time, for people that do suffer from congenital illnesses, that have suffered from some sort of injury, that's the more near-term future of this sort of research.
And Tucker, are paraplegics focused upon because some paraplegics might already have some kind of an electronic implant in their brain to function better?
Yeah, that's a good point. In theory, what you want out of this is something that is upgradable at minimal invasive expense, right?
Elon Musk saying that we already have artificial intelligence that is monitoring the border between North Korea and South Korea. There have been reports out of Japan that in the process of building autonomous weaponized robots for military application, the robots have turned on the lab people making them. So if we go into autonomous artificial intelligence, that takes the human out of the equation, Musk is defining as an existential threat.
In many ways, that is true. I think that there are a couple of different weapon systems that qualify. I would say that the main effect that it is going to have, particularly on warfare, is it does accelerate the pace of it. But potentially, it also accelerates its conclusion. So it's impossible to predict in a large human-scale way the effects of that acceleration on every dimension of combat or conflict.
But are you afraid that we are looking at a future in which cyborg creation is going to increasingly be what our Department of Defense is going to depend upon?
I wouldn't say that I'm actually afraid of that. I might be afraid if other peer nation states were realizing tremendous benefit from it and we weren't.
So we must compete in order to be competitive with our international adversaries.
I'm not certain of that.
But that cyborgs are inevitable?
Yeah, I think cyborgs are inevitable, totally inevitable. But fear them not.
I'm not sure about fear them not, Linda.
No, I'm not either, frankly. And I want to just sort of take everybody who has just heard this and shift to what we heard about for a long time in the 80s into the 90s about these embedded panels that have been found on a variety of retrieved extraterrestrial craft. And I am still in Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso's book, The Day After Roswell. And he wrote, in the alien craft are deck panels where there were indentations for the creature's hands. The indentations on these panels, as the Roswell field reports described them, looked like the handprints pressed into the concrete at the old Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. were the directional commands a series of electronic instructions transmitted directly from the creature's brains along their bodies and through the panels into the ship itself, as if the ship were only an extension of the creature's body. For that to have been the case, then what was the engine? And it goes into this interface between the brain of the extraterrestrials, their hands, with the nerves coming from the brain through their hands, embedded in a panel in which we found fiber optics at the each fingertip, and that meant that there was a joining or a contact between the fingertips and inside these embedded hands. And then when they followed the fiber optics, it went through the panels and into the walls, and that the entire craft was loaded with what we would call fiber optics today, that transmitted all this information directly by the control of the ET brain into their hands and their nerves to the craft, and that we are, the report was about DARPA putting a brain chip into a human that would be able to control up to 3 airplanes with their minds. So I think that we are copying. This is part of the back engineering of extraterrestrial technology.
It sounds that way, doesn't it? It really
very
does.
Much. Yeah, there's no question in my mind that was the impetus for doing this, and that we are moving so rapidly, George, into what will be the age of cyborgs. There's no question. You, I, every human would like to have enhancement and strength and longer life and health. And that means that when Elon Musk says, for humans to remain relevant for the rest of this century, they must become cyborgs, I think is true.
We're coming back next hour with Conversations with Linda. We'll take your phone calls next.